Good morning. Appreciate Fred's comments earlier. It's been pretty interesting the last couple of weeks, spending some time with various groups here at the chapel, search committee, and then elders and deacons. And Diane and I appreciate so much the thoroughness and the thoughtfulness of their work. It's not an easy task that they have representing you. We're pretty humbled to be able to participate in it, as together we attempt to discern if God is in this. Sent Fred Thompson an email a few days ago because I had a few slides that I wanted to use in my talk today. I realized after I'd sent it that there were some typos in it. So I quickly resent it and realized that I misspelled the word typo. So don't tell the search committee about that. It may not bode well with them. When I found out what the passage was today, Genesis 38, I wondered if they had made a mistake. I thought of maybe getting in touch with Bob and seeing if perhaps there was an alternate selection, but I thought better of that. Genesis 38 is... I've got a slide. Let's put the slide up here. When I first read through it, I didn't know if we needed a disclaimer like that. But as I continued to read and reflect and meditate on it, I felt otherwise. I've really become somewhat attached to this passage. I see it as far less risque than I may have the first time that I read through it. I think it really takes some very common themes in the Bible, and it develops them, albeit in some unusual ways, in some important ways. I was having coffee with Wayne Tomalty this week. One of the nice things about living in Edmonton, some of you may not think there are many, but one of the nice things about living in Edmonton is that I've been able to get to know Wayne Tomalty all over again. But we get together fairly regularly, and he was actually slated to preach today. So by the search committee inviting me, he effectively got bumped. So I met with him. I didn't know how apologetic I needed to be. And I said, "So Wayne, what are you doing this weekend?" And he said, "Terry, I think I might come to Red Deer to see what you do with Genesis 38. Because he said, "I was sure wondering what I was going to do with it." So we had some good table fellowship at Starbucks. Well, this is kind of unique, isn't it? I mean, often when I'm asked to speak to a group that I haven't spoken to for a long time, I don't have much history with them. And I have history with a good number of you, not with all of you. And so it's kind of an interesting patch of ground that I have to stand on today. I've thought about that, and sometimes I've just been filled with utter delight, and other times I've been rather nervous about it. So we'll see how things go here today as we look into Genesis 38. A number of years ago, I was purchasing my first iPad. The deal was that if you ordered it online, they would put some engraving on the back. And I thought, boy, what am I going to put on there? You know, I could put my name, but I thought that's kind of nerdy, so I don't want to do that. I had been reading a book by John Dyer, who works at Dallas Seminary. He's a technology specialist, and he's written a very interesting book about faith and technology. And there was this slogan, I guess you could call it, on his website. And when I read it, it really resonated with me. Technology is fast. My iPad is pretty fast. Redemption is slow. And when I read that, I thought, that's what I believe. That's what I've experienced. That's what I see in the Bible. So I wasn't surprised when I came to Genesis 38, and lo and behold, I stumbled across the theme of redemption. The way I'm putting Genesis 38 together, I realize that we're in a series on the book of Genesis, 50 chapters. And the last great story in Genesis starts in 37. I believe Bob Northey started it off last week. I actually listened to part of his sermon. Bob, I'll have to go back and catch the rest. But I wanted to find out what had been said. And I thought, what was said was so well said. What a solid sermon. Maybe you need to offer the job to Bob. But the way I'm seeing Genesis 38 is that it's a story. It's a redemption story in a story. 37 to 50 is a story. 37 to 50 is a great story of redemption. It's the redemption of God's people, the descendants of Jacob, through the servant of the Lord, Joseph. And they're redeemed from the threat of starvation, famine, and the like. They were going through some real tough times. And now chapter 38, when you start reading it, you feel like, oops, whoever put this together made a mistake. This just doesn't seem to fit. And yet it kind of does. It's a redemption story, but it's a different kind of redemption story. Now we're not redeeming a nation, we're redeeming a person who is so badly in need of redemption. So that's kind of how I'm putting it together. I'm seeing it as a story within a story. A number of years ago, people who sold TVs used to talk about picture-in-a-picture technology. And I'm seeing 38 as kind of the smaller picture. But it, too, is a story of redemption. A couple of months ago, I was reading through Genesis, not knowing that I would be preaching from Genesis anytime soon. And the impression that 37 to 50 had on me, the section that you guys are in right now, when I got to the end of the book, I thought, these guys, these brothers, they are different from the people that I met at the beginning of the story. They've changed. And now as I came back and reflected on it and studied it a bit more carefully, I realized that it's not just the brothers in general who have changed, but it's Judah in particular. And so I want us to look at this redemption story of Judah predominantly. And the question that comes to my mind is, how'd that happen? When I meet somebody and I feel like they're different, they're better. How did that happen? The person I remember wasn't that hot really, but I like him now. How did that happen? And I think Genesis 38 contains some clues. Chapter 38 is a pivotal moment in the life of Judah. So, Judah's road to redemption. By the way, I like this slide because it kind of blends, you know, the biblical characters but into a slightly modern setting. So, that's not actually what they wore back then. I don't think the guys wore black hats like that. So, I'm seeing three pieces in this story of redemption. The first piece I'm going to call the unpleasant piece, verses 1 to 5. And then there's the most important piece, it's called the humiliation piece, verses 12 to 26. This is really the heart and soul of the passage. And then the third piece in this redemption story is the blessing piece. Thankfully, there's resolution. I don't like stories that have bad endings, and this story has kind of a good ending, so that's good. So let's look at the unpleasant piece. Before I read the first five verses, I just want to mention that I have to spill over a little bit into Bob's passage from last week, because this story within a story actually draws on themes that happened just before 38, and then it'll also draw on themes that happen after 38. So I'm going to have to, you know, just step briefly out of my passage, so I hope I don't steal too much thunder from future speakers. So that's my apology to you guys. Well, this unpleasant piece, we meet a man by the name of Judah. He is not a nice man. And the first thing that we learn about him in chapter 37 is that he's a rather surly individual. And when I think of the word surly, I also want to add the word mean. Mean and surly go together, and I think that's the kind of person Judah was, and that's how we would have experienced him when we first met him. Why do we say that? Well, for one thing, he, along with his brothers, hate their baby brother. I mean, that's what it says, doesn't it? 37. You read it last week. They hate him. And they are jealous of him. And not only that, but Judah strikes me as a man who is unfeeling. He is not a man who is known for compassion. He is unfeeling. And when his brothers hatch this plot to erase their brothers, and I just can't imagine that. I mean, Bob, you mentioned last week sibling rivalry. I grew up in a family of five children, and there was tons of sibling rivalry. And we duked it out sometimes. There wasn't the fruit of the Spirit all the time in our home. But we never thought of literally erasing one of the kids. And that's what they did. That's what they planned. Now, when Judah heard about it, he agreed with Reuben, yes, let's not kill him. And in Reuben's case, of course, he was going to help him later on. He was going to rescue him. But Judah says, Or, I mean, essentially what he's doing is he's engaging in human trafficking. Let's make money. Let's not kill him, but let's make a profit from our dastardly deed. So he's a pretty surly and mean guy. 38, verses 1 through 5. Let me read that, and then I'll make a few comments. We've got a lot of verses here, so we're going to have to move along. Reading from the NIV. At that time, that is, while Joseph was languishing in Egypt, at that time, Judah left his brothers and went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hira. There Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua. He married her and made love to her. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son who was named Ur. She conceived again and gave birth to a son and named him Onan. She gave birth to still another son and named him Shelah. It was at Kazib that she gave birth to him. The action is really fast flowing at this point. The thing I observe about Judah here is that he's for himself. He moves. He marries. He doesn't consult. He's a lone ranger. He's not a team player. He's doing exactly what Father Abraham didn't want his descendants to do. He didn't want them to live among the Canaanites, and if they did live among the Canaanites, for sure, he didn't want them to intermarry with the Canaanites. That's exactly what Judah does. He's his own man. He likes something, he takes it. He's for himself. Verses 6 through 11. We learn something about the dysfunctional family that he is a part of. I used to talk about dysfunctional families like they were out there. And now I realize that dysfunctional families are in here. They're in our churches. The reason why we are dysfunctional is because we are related to Adam. And when Adam and Eve ventured forth and flexed their muscles of independence in the Garden of Eden, they brought a curse which included dysfunction upon themselves and the human race. So we're not totally unfamiliar with some of the dynamics of this family. Verses 6 through 11, let me read that. Judah got a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, this is a custom now, sleep with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to raise up offspring for your brother. But Onan knew that the child would not be his, so whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from providing offspring for his brother. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death also. Judah then said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, live as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought he may die too, just like his brothers. So Tamar went to live in her father's household. Some pretty interesting material here. We'll have to do some summarizing. This is a dysfunctional character. The first thing that we learn about is their character. Son number one. His name in Hebrew, if you reverse the letters, is the word for wickedness. Backwards is wicked. And he was a wicked man. We don't know what exactly that entailed, but he was a wicked man. And both he and brother number two died premature deaths. They were so wicked that the Lord deemed it necessary to intervene and to take their lives. And so they died. I guess you could say they were killed by God. Now in all of this, and I realize that these two brothers died under suspicious circumstances, but we ought not to forget that they did die, that Judah lost two children. And even though they may not have been Boy Scouts, they were his children. And I cannot imagine how difficult that must have been. I have been spared the loss of a child. I have friends who have lost children. You probably do too. They're not the same afterwards. And sometimes years later, I find myself whispering in my soul, I wonder when they'll get over this. And of course they don't. They get a little stronger and they get a little wiser, but they never get over it. We must not forget about the humanity of Judah. He lost two children. I think this ultimately was part of his humiliation. Well, we also learn in this segment of Genesis 38 about some what I'll call anti-family tendencies. His son had a duty, an obligation. We call it levirate marriage. Lever is a Latin word that means brother-in-law. And it worked fairly simply. And you probably are familiar with this, but in case you're not, let me try to explain it to you. If your older brother married and his wife was widowed because he died, it would be your responsibility as the next brother to marry her and to have children with her, and in so doing to build up the family. This was a pro-family thing. It was a social custom. It was eventually embedded in the Old Testament law, so it was a sacred custom. It was your duty. Unless we think that this is a really strange custom, you need to know that there are parts of the world where levirate marriage continues to be practiced. However, son number two said, no, I don't want to do this, at least not the way it's supposed to be done. And just to give us a feel for how serious not fulfilling that duty was, I want to read to you a few verses from Deuteronomy 25. If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brothers shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. He was to build up the family. In Israelite culture, in the ancient Near East, one of the worst things that could ever happen to a person was that they be forgotten, that their family line not be extended, that it be blotted out. And so this was unthinkable. It was horrible. Now it goes on to describe what they thought of the person who was unwilling to fulfill his duty. Verse 7, however, if a man does not want to marry his brother's wife, like Onan, she shall go to the elders of the town gate and say, my husband's brother refuses to carry on his brother's name in Israel. He will not fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to me. Then the elders of his town shall summon him and talk to him. If he persists in saying, I do not want to marry her, his brother's widow shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, take off one of his sandals, spit in his face. Can you imagine this in public? The spittle starting to run down his face and mesh with his beard. Shall spit in his face and say, this is what is done to the man who will not build up his brother's family line. That man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled, which was a mega insult. Look, there goes John. He's one of the family of the unsandaled. His name would be Mud. So we have these anti-family tendencies. I was trying to think what a modern-day case of this might be, of someone who wouldn't fulfill his duty in a family. This is a very imperfect example, but I know recently there have been a couple of cases in Canada where family members have left young children in vehicles with the windows up or almost up on very hot days. This happened in Ontario a couple of days back, a week ago, I think. It was in a shopping facility, and some people noticed that a child was in the vehicle. And when the parents came back, boy, did the crowd give them a rough time. They may have thought and felt and treated them like family members of the unsandaled. This is an anti-family thing to do. And this, of course, is what son one and son two of Judah did. And then the father, in verse 11, we read that he just dismissed his daughter-in-law. My two sons are dead. He just dismissed her. Whatever happened to bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh? She was now part of Judah's clan. He wasn't supposed to just send her back to her own family. It was his responsibility and the responsibility of the family to provide for her and to care for her. And they're acting in very anti-family ways. So these are some of the unpleasant pieces of Judah. Then in verses 12 to 26, we move to what we call the humiliation piece. Now things get sticky. There is an after effect of their failure to fulfill family obligations, and it creates a real dilemma for Tamar. And let me read 12 to 23. It's a fairly long section, so kind of feeling like the need for a little shut-eye. This is the time to grab it. After a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. When Judah had recovered from his grief, he went up to Timnah, to the men who were shearing his sheep, and his friend Hira, the Adullamite, went with him. When Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear his sheep," she took off her widow's clothes, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then sat down at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that though Shelah had now grown up, she had not been given him as his wife. In other words, Tamar, being the intelligent, shrewd woman that she is, realizes nobody is looking out for her. Everybody is looking after themselves. Nobody's going to fulfill their duty. Pretty resourceful lady. She takes matters into her own hands. This is what she did. Verse 15. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, "Come now, let me sleep with you." "And what will you give me to sleep with you?" she asked. "I'll give you a young goat from my flock," he said. "Will you give me something as a pledge until you send it?" she asked. He had left his wallet and his credit cards at home, and so she asked him for a little collateral, a little insurance. He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" "Your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand," she answered. So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. After she left, she took off her veil and put on her widow's clothes again. Meanwhile, Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, in order to get his pledge back from the woman, but he did not find her. He asked the men who lived there, "Where is the shrine prostitute who was beside the road at Enaim?" "There hasn't been any shrine prostitute here," he said. So he went back to Judah and said, "I didn't find her. Beside, the men who lived there said there hasn't been any shrine prostitute here." So Judah said, "Let her keep what she has, or we will become a laughingstock. After all, I did not send her this young goat." I did send her this young goat, but didn't find her. Well, she shrewdly exchanges sex for collateral, and then she discovers that she is pregnant, which is what she wanted all along, which is what Judah didn't want all along. He didn't want his daughter-in-law to conceive. She did. And then she proceeds to boldly expose him. If you've been following the news this week, one of our Alberta MLAs was arrested in a prostitution sting in the States. I imagine he's really embarrassed. I hope he's more than embarrassed. I hope he's humiliated. You can't really tell from some of the press releases. But when I think about what it must have been like when word hit the fan regarding what had happened, I wonder if that's maybe not a bit how Judah must have felt. Let me keep reading here. Verses 24 to 26. About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution, and as a result, she is now pregnant." Judah said, "Bring her out and have her burned to death." As she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. "I am pregnant by the man who owns these," she said. And she added, "See if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are." Judah recognized them. He must have been mortified. She pulled out his wallet, his driver's license. Oh, Judah recognized them and said, notice what he said. "She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son Shelah." And he did not sleep with her again. So she's entered into this arrangement with him. Now she has boldly exposed him. He confesses, what a strange confession. He confesses that she is standing on higher moral ground than he. We need to put that into perspective. Now, some of you have read Les Miserables, the story of Jean Valjean. My dear wife took me to Les Mis last weekend in Edmonton. It was great. Well, Jean Valjean was a convict, was in jail for almost 20 years. Do you know why he went to jail? He had stole bread. It was during an economic recession. These were hard times. And his sister's children were starving to death. And there were no jobs. And so he stole food to feed the family. He stole for the family. I think that there is a sense. No, he did steal. We're not arguing about that. There is a sense in which what Tamar did was similar. She misbehaved. Yes, she was guilty of misconduct. But when nobody else was going to protect the family's interests, nobody was going to do the duty, She came up with a plan to act for the family. She built up the family. Yes, she engaged in an immoral act. But yes, she acted for the family. So as we think about how we want to judge this woman, we need to keep all of those facts in mind. So Judah recognizes that she is standing on higher moral ground than he. She's exposed him. He's a liar. He said he was going to do one thing, and he did another. He's an immoral man, and he's a hypocrite. He's pretending to be this big-shot, super-duper righteous guy, and he's got this double life. Maybe a bit like the MLA. The curtain has been drawn back for all to see. And you know, it could have made him bitter, but I don't think it did. I think it made him better. And so that brings us to our third piece. There's been the unpleasant piece, the humiliation piece. Judah has been pushed off his horse, and it was a high one. And he's hit the ground. He's bit the dust. What is he gonna do? This is when you find out what you're made of. When you've made a mistake, and you've been discovered, what are you gonna do now? Verses 27 to 30, I'm not gonna read it. I'll let you read that, but incredible thing is that it all turns out for great blessing. In 27 to 30, there is a name that pops up, Perez. And if you don't know any other strange name from the Old Testament, you may recognize the name Perez, because when you get to the end of the book of Ruth, and the concern of the author is to tell you about the genealogy of King David, guess which name leads the pack? Perez. And when you get to Matthew chapter 1 and you're reading about the genealogy of Jesus, whose name shows up? Perez. And so I suppose you could say that Tamar, by all of her antics, produced not only a line for Judah that included David, but also Jesus as well. So when you're thinking about judging this woman, you might want to keep that in mind as well. He's blessed with offspring. Now, I mentioned earlier that when you get to the end of the book of Genesis, you meet this guy, Judah, who's really quite a nice man, this surly, mean guy that you'd read about earlier in the book. And now that he's come through this incredible experience of humiliation, and he has learned from it, and he has grown through it, we now meet a rather nice guy. In chapter 43 and chapter 44, we meet a guy who now has great feeling for people. He's now in front of a man that he doesn't recognize, Joseph, his brother. He just thinks that he's a man with power, that he's a man who can hurt him. And he's making some unusual requests, unreasonable requests. He's asking to be able to detain one of their brothers, and he's pleading now. He has compassion. He's a man of feeling. He is now for the family. We've never seen a Judah like this before. And he's willing to exchange himself. He's willing to put his safety and his reputation and his well-being on the line in order to act for the family. And I'm sorry, but when I get to this part of the book, I think, holy smokes, what happened to this guy? And I think it has a lot to do with his humiliation back in chapter 38. We won't go there again, but, well, maybe just a little bit. When you get to the end of Genesis, Jacob is on his deathbed, and he's blessing people. Who do you suppose he saves his biggest and best blessing for? Surly, mean Judah. And he says, Judah, your brothers will praise you. You are a lion's cub. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nations shall be his. I can't think of a less deserving guy in the Joseph story to get a blessing like that. But such is the peace of honor. So often in the wake of humiliation, there is this incredible generosity on the part of God. Once a person is in trouble and they recognize it and they come clean, and God is prepared to bless and to honor. Kind of a neat story. Starts off kind of weird, and I know there's some edgy, risque stuff in there, but after all, it is a redemption story. Well, what about our redemption? We hear a lot about redemption these days, you know. Did you see that movie? Wasn't there great redemption towards the end? Christians are really big on redemption, and redemption can be used in many different ways. I think usually we think of redemption in the sense of rescue from the tyranny of sin, and that's a good way of using it. How do you feel about this rescue story, this redemption story? Does it encourage you? Does it encourage you that God would reach out to someone who through no fault of their own was in trouble, Jacob's descendants, and bless them? Does it encourage you that God would reach out to somebody who so has jerk written all over their resume and bless them and honor them? This is what God does. This is what our God does. And I think there's a sense in which he wants us to mimic and imitate him. When business has been done, when things have been dealt with, then he's ready to say, back up the blessing truck, okay? We're now ready to move forward and to proceed with the Judas of this world. I think the older I get, the more excited I get about redemption. The more excited I get about the plan of God to put things right. We live in a world that is oh so broken and broken down. It is oh so not the way it was supposed to be. And the good news of the gospel is that redemption has begun. It's already leaking into the here and now. Often it seems way too slow. But it is already making its appearance through the cross work of Jesus Christ. He is the world's redeemer. We yearn for redemption for ourselves and for others. We need to be assured that God will do this work of redemption. But we need to keep some things in mind, perhaps even this week, as we live out our own journey of redemption. I don't know what your journey looks like. Some of you know more about my journey of redemption than I know about yours. And I hope I get a chance to hear a little bit more about yours. Redemption takes a while. The one who is the master of redemption often is not in a hurry. Now, we're in a hurry. Remember once Mr. Huber told me a story about a guy who was pacing back and forth. Maybe he saw some of that in Terry Weeb. This guy was pacing back and forth, and he was asked, what's the problem? And he said, well, I'm in a hurry, and God's not. And often we feel that way about the redemption of our spouses, or the redemption of our children, or the redemption of our neighbors, of our family, and our friends. I've had the wonderful experience of pretty much giving up on some people. I mean, I prayed for 20 years. That should be long enough. If it hasn't happened yet, God's probably forgotten. And lo and behold, God saves them. No thanks to me or my prayers. It takes a while. Decades isn't too long for God. Redemption also can get pretty gritty. Genesis 38, that's pretty gritty stuff. Like, I'm not thinking you want to take this into your next junior high Bible study or, you know, Bible lesson in DVBS. Send your kids to Balmoral Bible Chapel this summer. We're going to teach your kids about Judah and Tamar. I don't think that'd be very popular. It's pretty, pretty gritty stuff. Those of us who have lived, or those of us who are married, and just those of us who are wise, we know about how gritty life can be. What's more gritty than Good Friday? What's more gritty than my God, why have you forsaken me? That's pretty gritty. It's pretty gritty that God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, not counting our sins against us. That's pretty gritty stuff. Redemption gets gritty. We're fallen. We live in a fallen world. And God gets right down into the mud. Not just your mud, but my mud. And not just your mud and my mud, but our mud. He seems to feel a lot more comfortable being there, doing his grand work of redemption, than maybe we are even to receive his presence. And maybe the last thing that I should say is that waiting for God's work of redemption is worth it. Some days we feel like quitting, throwing in the towel, giving up. It's not happening. It's not going to happen. It's worth the wait. If Judah was here today, he would say to us, oh, trust me, it was worth the wait. You wouldn't believe all the stuff that I had to go through to get to that place of blessing in my life. It was worth the wait. It's worth waiting for God's redemptive act. Father, thank you for Scripture, the way that it is a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. Thank you for the ministry of your word in our lives. Thank you for this marvelous theme of redemption, that you really are the one who will put things right, even though they could never put Humpty Dumpty back together again. You have both the will and the ability to put creation back together. Whether we're old or young, whether we're novices in the faith or mature, whether we've sinned little or lots, you are the God who was willing to come alongside of us. Help us to know you in that way. Help us to carry this sense of assurance that you will do it. You are doing it. Did it with Tamar. Can do it with us. Then, Father, I thank you for the ministry of Balmoral Chapel. You know about their journey, where they've been, where they are, and where they're going. And we ask that you would continue to bless, that you would continue to be the God who inspired that incredible slogan, "Be still and know that I am God." Continue to reveal yourself here in amazing ways. Thank you that your work is not done, but it is ongoing. So we commend these dear believers to you in Jesus' name.